From the WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the unexpected legacy of divorce. We talk with Judith Wallerstein about her 25-year study of the children of divorced parents. The children she's tracked are adults now, and their lives are still affected by divorce. Wallerstein's findings are on the cover of this week's Time magazine. She reports on her research in a new book. Also today, the sex lives of teenagers. We talk with psychiatrist Lynn Ponton, who counsels teens and their parents. Her new book is about teenagers' sexual expectations, fears, and insecurities. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal regulators have raised the number of fatal accidents they're investigating in connection with the Bridgestone-Firestone tire recall. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has added 15 deaths to its list, bringing the total to 103. Investigators say the fatalities and more than 400 injuries are linked to crashes caused by blowouts and tread separation on the tires. Firestone has recalled more than 6 million tires. President Clinton welcomed today's passage of legislation to give China permanent normal trade status with the United States, calling it an important milestone in relations between the two countries. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
Getting permanent normal trade status for China was a top priority for the Clinton administration. The president said the measure should mean more opportunities for U.S. businesses and more freedom for the Chinese people.
And we will find, I believe, that America has more influence in China with an outstretched hand than with a clenched fist.
He said open trade with China will increase U.S. leverage on such issues as human rights, arms proliferation, the environment, and labor standards. Opponents said quite the contrary, that annual review of China's trade status gave the U.S. more say over Chinese policies. But business and farm groups lobbied heavily for the bill. The Senate cleared the measure by a vote of 83 to 15. The president is expected to sign it very soon. Pam Fessler, NPR News. The White House.
A Coast Guard helicopter is on its way to pick up one of the survivors of a hijacked Cuban seaplane that crashed today in the Gulf of Mexico. Coast Guard officials say 9 people, including 3 children, survived the crash and were rescued by a passing cargo ship. One body was recovered from the wreckage. The Food and Drug Administration wants to warn doctors that overprescribing antibiotics can lead to serious medical problems. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Antibiotics are great at treating bacterial infections, but when bacteria are exposed to a lot of antibiotics, the microbes are great at finding ways to resist the drugs. Public health experts have long urged doctors to prescribe fewer antibiotics, using them only when they're needed. Now the FDA is proposing that manufacturers add a warning on the labels that go with antibacterial drugs, reminding doctors to specifically match the antibiotic to the infection. For one type of infection, though, there may be another way to circumvent antibiotic resistance. Researchers at a science conference in Toronto say that a new vaccine can prevent a type of staphylococcus infection. Staph infections are among the most likely to develop antibiotic resistance. The vaccine cut the infection rate in half in nearly 2,000 patients, at least in the short run. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 19 points to close at 10,789 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 125 points. This is NPR. Some 500,000 Los Angeles area commuters are finding their own way home on the fourth day of the city's transit strike. More talks are set for tomorrow on the strike by 4,300 bus and rail operators. The union says its representatives will be there, but it's not ready to reopen contract talks. The crew of Space Shuttle Atlantis is less than a day away from its planned landing in Florida. The 5 astronauts and 2 cosmonauts are wrapping up a mission to install equipment and deliver cargo to the International Space Station. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
The weather is the big concern for the Wednesday morning touchdown. Low clouds and rain are possible in the forecast, but the shuttle has enough fuel to stay up until Friday if necessary. The crew has free time for now to observe the Earth from orbit. NASA scientist Roger Crouch flew twice on Space Shuttle Columbia in 1997. He says he saw a lot of territory from space.
45 minutes I went from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, out over the Sahara, up over Egypt, up over Pakistan, went up over the Himalayas, and then back down over Indonesia, the Micronesia, all those islands going down that way.
Discovery is the next shuttle to fly in October. The 7-member crew will install a truss on the space station where the first solar power panels will be attached. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Opposition parties in Peru want President Alberto Fujimori to hold new elections as quickly as possible. Peru's justice minister says the government currently plans to schedule the elections for next March, with Fujimori and the Peruvian Congress to remain in power until the end of July. Opposition parties say Fujimori is implicated in a bribery scandal involving his top advisor and should resign immediately. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. More than 40% of first marriages in the U.S. end in divorce. Each year, about 1 million children have parents who divorce. My guest, Judith Wallerstein, has been studying the children of divorce for the past 25 years. During that time, she's tracked 93 children of divorced parents. Those children are now adults themselves, ranging in age from their late 20s to early 40s. Wallerstein has found that the after effects of divorce continue to have an impact on children even after they've reached adulthood. Wallerstein's findings have made the cover of this week's Time magazine and are reported in her new book, The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. She says that her research disproves the common belief that if parents are happier after divorce, their children will be happier too.
Well, I think people have told themselves for a long time that if the adults are unhappy in the marriage, or if one adult is unhappy in the marriage, that the children would be unhappy. And that's just simply not true. I've seen the book talks only about 93 children over a 25-year period, but in the center that I direct, I've seen over 6,000 children, more than anybody else in America. And most of them were surprised at the decision to divorce, and most of them were not unhappy in the marriage. The sense that, or the common belief that people are throwing dishes or screaming at each other, and that they're it's the high conflict marriages that come to divorce is not true. The conflict often happens in the final scenes of a dying marriage after one person has filed for divorce. So that's what the attorneys and the courts see. But high conflict is by no means typical of many divorces. People divorce for loneliness. People divorce because they've lost respect for the other person. People divorce because of, a great many feelings of disenchantment with the marriage and feeling there must be something better in my life. People divorce because of a great deal of sexual deprivation. In some of the families I've seen, there's been years without sex. And in fact, as I show in the book, people also divorce when external events like a loss ricochet into the marriage and people have needs which are no longer met by the other person, and also because of high conflict. But it is not a characteristic of divorcing families until the very end of the marriage.
Now that you've studied children of divorce in their late 20s through their early 40s, do you think that the effects of divorce keep on going, keep on affecting children into adulthood?
Well, this now is the major finding of my study, that they do keep on going. I should say, by way of history, that when I started to study the effects of divorce on children in the early 70s, and when the prevailing opinion was, have a divorce. I mean, a divorce has no impact of any length on children. And when I started to write about that I'd seen children badly shaken by their parents' divorce, I got a lot of angry response. I got angry letters from attorneys and from mental health colleagues saying, how could you say that what's better for the mother or the father isn't a joy that would be shared by the children? Now that work is considered a classic, and it's generally accepted that divorce is a very troublesome, very upsetting experience for a child at the time of the breakup. And now I'm saying, once again, in opposition to conventional wisdom, that the major effects that I'm seeing now are those in adulthood. And although that the period of divorce itself is very painful for the child, I'm not withdrawing that opinion. I was one of its chief architects. I am saying that in terms of the suffering of the child, the greatest impact is in their early 20s when they confront the man-woman situation and the ghosts all rise from the basement, the memories become vivid, and they're very frightened that they will fail.
In studying the children of divorce, what impact have you found that divorce has on the children's confidence in choosing a partner for their own marriage?
Well, the children are, as adults now, we're talking their early 20s.
Yeah.
Many of them are convinced that they're just going to go down the same path as their parents did. And at an age when you're really looking for love and you're looking for commitment and you're looking to start a new family, and I mean, that's the time in your life when it really is most important. And these young people are really convinced that they're going to fail. They talk about it very strongly. They say, I'm convinced that any relationship I'd be involved in, I would jinx. What would keep my relationships from failing? And they expect to be abandoned. They expect to be betrayed. How can I have what my mother didn't have? And so on. And it's with a great deal of suffering that they say that. They're not a cynical generation, which I think we should be grateful for. They're not saying, who cares, who needs marriage, the heck with it. They want what their parents didn't succeed in keeping, and this is what upsets them profoundly.
They want it, but they're afraid that they'll never be able to achieve it.
They're not only afraid, but because they're so scared and because they feel that they're so poorly prepared. They say, I'm not prepared for marriage. I've never seen a man and a woman on the same beam. Sometimes I feel I've been raised on a desert island. The notion that of combining sexual intimacy and love is a strange idea to me. These are all direct quotes. I haven't modified them. They feel that they're unprepared, and they are unprepared. They have no idea how to settle an argument in a relationship without seeing it as the disaster that they were afraid of. And their first thought is, I'm out of here. They don't have a model in their head that people from intact families are able, I mean reasonably intact families are able to draw on when they run into the ordinary difficulties of life, and they choose poorly, they get involved in relationships that are bad from the beginning, they have trouble leaving a relationship because they say with unexpected sweetness, they say, I can't do to another human being what my mom did to my dad.
Now, the alternative for parents who no longer really love each other and are afraid of the effect of divorce on their children, the alternative is to stay together and still not really love each other. Some parents do that. You've studied the children. You've studied some children who grew up in families like that. Do they have fewer problems than their counterparts whose parents did divorce?
Well, let me just say one thing before I respond to your question. There are a lot of divorces in which only one person wants out of the marriage. It isn't by any means the notion that two people no longer love each other. It is that one person wants out and the other person may agree or may resist it. So our view of the divorcing family is somewhat skewed. But there are, as you say, a lot of families that I studied where the parents were unhappy with each other, where they suffered with loneliness, not with violence. That's a whole different category. But where the couple suffered with loneliness, where there was a lot of suspicion, where they essentially had many of the problems that the parents from the divorcing families had, because I followed the parents too for all these years, but where they decided to stay together, not to be martyrs to protect the children, because that's not a good solution, to be a martyr, but because they found the parenting sufficiently rewarding and sufficiently important in their lives that they decided to stay together. And yes, where the parents were able to maintain the parenting successfully, those young people had an easier time growing up and an easier time with marriage.
My guest is Judith Wallerstein. Her new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Judith Wallerstein is my guest, and she's done a study of the children of divorce. She's followed them for the past 25 years. Her new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. So who are the lucky children?
There are two kinds of lucky children. The lucky children are the children in either very happy marriages or troubled marriages. But where the parenting is maintained as a high priority by the parents, and that would be true in the divorced families as well. I'm not arguing for or against divorce. I'm not saying that, in fact, I'm arguing very strongly that nobody from the outside can take a position about how happy or unhappy. You can't quantify unhappiness, how lonely, how deprived people feel within the marriage. But I am saying that when people divorce, they know what they're getting away from. I don't want to spend another day of my life with James. That they know. But they don't know what they're getting into, and they don't know how much time and how much attention and how much reassurance their children are going to need, not at the time of the breakup alone, but during their whole period of growing up, especially when they get into adolescence, especially when they get into late adolescence and young adulthood, that they can have their own standards and choose better than their parents did and establish a better relationship, and that the parents' marriage isn't typical of what goes on in marriage.
Well, let's look at some of the things that happen in the years after divorce that may have a negative effect on the children. I mean, one big issue for divorcing parents, should there be joint custody? Should the child be spending equal time or kind of equal time with both parents and going back and forth between two different households? What are some of the pros and cons you've found about that shuttling back and forth type of arrangement?
Well, I found very, and I consider this very serious, that one reason the children felt that they had lost their childhood is they felt that their play and their friendships and their activities had been very much cut into by going back and forth. And this isn't only in joint custody. I mean, this is the whole issue that my mom is here and my dad is there. And what we haven't realized hardly at all, and the courts and the mediators rarely consider, and I think this is a major finding here, is that the importance of friendships and the importance of play for the child has been neglected in the rush to defend the father's rights and the mother's rights. And very few of these children, none of these children, when they grew up, remembered an afternoon with mommy or an afternoon with daddy. I'm sure there were. But they remembered, they didn't talk at all about play and friendships as children, whereas those children in the intact families couldn't stop talking about their backyard play, how they drove their mother crazy, how they their best friend was somebody they talked about. And these were sunlit memories. They were very important memories, even in homes where the children were worried about their parents and where their parents were not all that happy together. But none of the people in the intact families where the parenting was maintained said, "I never had a childhood." And obviously you can grow up without a childhood. I mean, children all over the world grow up without childhoods. But this is middle-class America. And these children felt like, especially in adolescence, like second-class citizens, because they weren't able to share in the high school activities, in the school dances on many occasions, because they were court-ordered or mediated by their parents to go back and forth. And this is serious. And when I've recently talked to a group of judges, I've emphasized how little attention we've given to the importance of growing up.
And children felt that they couldn't control their own time. They had no choice
of how
powerless. To spend their weekends or and where they were going to spend their weekends.
They're very angry. They say, "I'm a second-class citizen." My friends in intact families choose their vacations. I mean, children don't govern the families. But in a reasonably good, intact family, the parents will turn to the child and say, "What would you like to do for the weekend? Or what would you like to do for July or whatever?" And some of these children who had been court-ordered or mediated to spend all of July with mom and all of August with dad felt that they were sentenced. I was surprised at this. They said, "Why was I sentenced? What did I do wrong?"
What are the alternatives that you'd suggest so that children could spend time with each of their parents after divorce but not feel like they're being second-class citizens with no say?
I think the child's growing up needs to be considered. If a court order is issued when the child is six, there needs to be some flexibility built in that the same routine isn't expected of the child when she's 13 or 14. I mean, this is terrible. I mean, someday I think we'll look back on this and say these are the Middle Ages in terms of children and their needs. How to build in that flexibility, I think, is a legal issue or a mediation issue. And that those are not my fields, but there could be automatic review built in without having to go back to a full dress court hearing or whatever, so that there's a recognition that children grow up, they change. A child is a moving object.
Now, for children who are going back and forth between two different households after divorce, when the parenting styles in each household is different, what impact does that have on the child? Does the child end up getting confused? What results did you find talking to those children who are now adults?
I didn't find that differences in the household were so difficult. It depended. I mean, like religious differences were not the major issue, and these are the ones that are considered by the courts. Kids adjusted to that. It intact families, there are lots of times religious differences. What was difficult is for young children, different sleep schedules were serious. If you went to bed at 8 o'clock in one home and you went to bed at 10 o'clock in the other, this was difficult. Different diets and so on. I mean, it's the devil is in the details of life. It's not in the major ideological issues. But the issue was not in the differences as much as feeling of that they didn't have the power to have any say over their lives. This was serious. And there was anger at the courts. And I don't think that's a good idea.
There's a new study that was led by a Princeton University professor of economics that found that children who were raised in families with a stepmother were likely to have less health care, less education, and less money spent on their food than children raised by their biological mothers. Does anything that you found fit with those findings?
Well, mine was a middle class group, and I think their health care was reasonably well protected. But I did find that there was relationships. Developing a relationship with a step parent is a triumph on both sides. And that we made a mistake of thinking that it only has to do with the step-parent and the child, that involves an orchestra. It involves the biological parent, the step-parent, the other biological parent, and the child or children. And it's a very it's very hard to orchestrate, for all of those people to orchestrate their relationship together. I mean, it's hard. It's just plain harder than doing than having a marriage first and then having children. It can be done.
Now, how does the treatment by step-parents affect the outcome for children of divorce? You know, studying the children of divorce in their late 20s through their early 40s now, if they had good relationships with step-parents, does that mean that they're more likely to feel more comfortable about marriage themselves?
Oh, yes. If they've had any example in their lives, not just in and out, but in their lives of a good marriage, it made a difference in their lives. It mm-hmm. made for a much more optimistic, confident outlook. In some of them, there were grandparents who were very active with the children and not taking sides. This is very important that the grandparents not take sides, but are experienced by the children as there for them. And when they grew up, they said very movingly, "My grandparents saved my life." I mean, these were serious business to them, and that they. I had one young woman who used to, when she got so tired taking care of her mom and her dad, she would go and sit with her grandmother and just sit in silence. And she said this was an oasis that kept her alive as a child. So any such good relationships were very helpful. I should tell you that what these children experienced as much as good step-parents is second divorces, and that the experience growing up for two-thirds of them were second marriages and second divorces, which then multiplied the losses. And I think in thinking about divorce, we've sort of concentrated on a model that's not realistic for many children, which is one marriage and one divorce. And for many of them, it's been several marriages and several divorces, plus a whole lot of losses of boyfriends, of lovers, of I mean, their parents are adults who are getting divorced in order to rebuild their lives. They're not there just to, you know, to sit and wait for Prince Charming to appear.
Judith Wallerstein's new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. She directs the Wallerstein Center for the Family in Transition. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Sabbath, Finding Rest, Renewal, and Delight in Our Busy Lives by Wayne Muller, now in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Teenagers now reach sexual maturity on average 2 years earlier than previous generations, but that doesn't mean they're emotionally ready for sex. Coming up, we talk with psychiatrist Lynn Ponton about teenagers' sexual expectations, insecurities, and misconceptions. And we continue our conversation about the children of divorce with Judith Wallerstein. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Judith Wallerstein. For 25 years, she's tracked a group of children whose parents divorced. Those children are now adults, ranging in age from their late 20s to early 40s. Wallerstein's findings are reported in her new book, The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. She found that the negative impact of divorce often continues to affect children even after they've reached adulthood. She thinks we can start learning from some mistakes. Let's look at some of the things you think we could be doing better. Let's start with parents. Some of the things you think parents should be thinking about when they divorce for the sake of their children.
Well, I think they should realize that it's important to think ahead in terms of how difficult it's going to be, that it can be done. And I've seen very good outcomes from divorce. And as I said, I'm not arguing against it, but that many people have no idea of how demanding it will be to reestablish their social lives, which have been really torn, and look and how much time it takes to find a new partner and to do that successfully, and also combine that with the financial responsibilities, which are very burdensome, and giving time to the children that the children need, because the children need more time, not less time, in the post-divorce years. And that they should know, and most people don't. In fact, most people hardly give time to telling their children about the divorce. They essentially do what I've called a real estate explanation of the divorce. Oh, your mom's going to live here and your dad's going to live there. And this is very frightening to children, because they assume then that the world can't be depended on, that your closest relationship can break up without reason.
What's the most important thing you think parents should do when they're getting divorced?
I think they have to get across to the children that the children are free to lead their own lives, that their parents would welcome a happy marriage on behalf of their children. I think they need to be there for the children during adolescence, and these children had much less protection than the children in intact families. Many of them never had a curfew as adolescents because their parents were so busy and preoccupied with their own relationships. And I think they need to be there for their children during adolescence, and also to be around for them, not as the recipients of care, but as people who can help them make their own way in young adulthood.
So do you think your findings should be interpreted as it's better to stay in a bad marriage than to divorce?
I'm being very careful not to say that. I really think, I'm convinced that cannot be recommended or said from the outside. Do I think parents should stand still and think and decide whether they can maintain their parenting after the divorce, whether they can maintain their parenting within the intact marriage, whether there's enough satisfaction and rewards in staying married? I think they should consider it very seriously, because as we began this conversation, it's not true that if the parents have an unhappy marriage, the children will be unhappy. The children who had parents who were not happy in the intact families where they maintained the parenting felt that they had a much better life than had their parents divorced.
Something I think I'd really disagree with you about is that 25 years ago, parents didn't think that divorce would have a harmful effect on children. I think that the notion that divorce was bad for children was so ingrained in American society, it was considered a shame for parents to divorce. It was a grave embarrassment. It was something to be avoided at all costs. And I think parents had to work really hard to get up the courage to divorce and to convince themselves that a child would survive it.
Well, I think the issue was that that divorce itself was considered not so nice, but the effect on the child was not understood at all, because the no-fault divorce started in California. California was the flagship state. It has been the flagship state in many ways. And it was there were several task forces. The bill was signed by Governor Reagan. The last task force was led by a very firm and well-known, distinguished law professor, was an advocate for women's rights. And there was no provision in those task forces for the financial issues that emerged very quickly, and everybody's view, and there was no concern or agenda for the children or its impact on the children. So I think the issue of divorce itself, partly because of the greater the salience of the church at that point, was considered a not nice thing to do for the couple to do, but concern about the children was secondary. And certainly at that time in California, there was an overall euphoria about marriage is going to improve. People are going to get rid of their mistakes. They're going to make wonderful second marriages, and the children will be happy. And it's a new day that's dawning. I mean, it's hard to recapture that euphoria. But I know that I was flying in the face of that when I started to look at this issue. And gradually, the work that my colleagues and I did and that other people did made clear that for the child, it was anything but a piece of cake.
Judith Wallerstein, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Judith Wallerstein's new book is called The Unexpected Legacy of Divorce. Coming up, teenagers' sexual expectations, fears, and misconceptions. We talk with psychiatrist Lynn Ponton. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Lynn Ponton, is the author of the new book, The Sex Lives of Teenagers. She's a psychiatrist who counsels troubled teenagers and their parents. She also works with teenagers who have HIV. She's worked with teenagers of different ethnic groups and economic backgrounds in the San Francisco Bay Area. Her new book examines teenagers' sexual expectations, insecurities, and misconceptions. This book grew out of her previous book, The Romance of Risk, which suggested that risk-taking is the primary way that adolescents discover and develop their identities. Sex has always been risky for girls because of the possibility of pregnancy. Risky for boys as well because of the possibility of, you know, syphilis or gonorrhea. But I think, you know, pregnancy was the more likely problem for teenagers. But now with sexually transmitted diseases being as varied and as common as they are, and I'm including AIDS in that, the risk for boys is, I think, greater than it ever was. Do you find that girls and boys kind of factor in risk in a different way when they're thinking about having sex for the first time?
Well, they do, Terry. And I think particularly with girls, have always known about the dangerous aspect of risk. In many ways, that's made them look askance at the healthier aspects. Girls have trouble focusing on their own desire and the positive aspects when danger is so much a part of it. So I would say, you know, from all the teens I've worked with in my office as the parent of teens, really watching girls think about sex, the dangerous part is right there at the same time. And it makes it harder, I think, to have healthy sex that makes them feel good about themselves. For boys, and just recently I had a conversation with Jocelyn Elders, and she said that she feels like HIV and AIDS has changed the face of sexuality for boys more than anything else. It's made them more aware of the risk that they face. So I think they too now approach at least sexual activity with another person with that idea in their mind. So in a way, it's kind of equalized the playing field for boys and girls. Not completely, but definitely changed it.
Did you find that most of the teenagers who you deal with in your practice understand sexuality, or do you find that a lot of them believe certain myths or mistruths about sexuality?
You know, I think the biggest misconception that we have as adults is that teenagers know everything about sex, that they're more experienced than we are. And that's actually not true. And many of the teens I've worked with are funny. Their misconceptions about sex are funny, and they're unexpected. One of the stories in the book is about a boy who masturbates with a vacuum cleaner. And before I did this type of work, I would never have thought of that. He had ideas about how this would increase his sexual prowess. And this was a misconception. And working with him really gave me much more empathy for teens everywhere as they kind of struggle with their sexuality, their ideas about it, their fantasies about it, and really what they think other people think of them.
What did he confide in you that made you understand more?
He told me that when he was with, first, that he was very concerned about having a powerful penis that worked when he compared himself with the boys at school. This was a young boy, really 13, 14, without a dad. His dad lived on the other side of the country. And as he kind of moved into his male identity, having a powerful penis that functioned in a vital way was a really important thing to him. And you'd think as a grown adult woman that I would have known this about men. But I think seeing and hearing it from so many 13, 14, 15-year-old boys made me much more aware of it and really more empathetic for some of the struggles that men and boys are going through with their sexuality. So that's what he told me.
I think this leads to another point that you make in your book, which is that most teenagers want to be able to think of themselves and of their sexual organs and their sexual lives as being normal. And, I mean, what is normal? And like, how do we measure normal?
Yeah. You know, Terry, it's really a pleasure to talk to you about this topic because I've already been kind of traveling last week. And I mentioned, they asked me what the book was about, and I mentioned many of the topics in the book and mentioned homosexuality. And one of the interviewers I had said, well, I don't want to talk about that. That's deviant with teenagers. And I was shocked. You know, it's fortunate I had some media experience. And I think recognizing that in adolescence, same sex and feelings for the opposite sex are very, very much a normal part of growing up. 30 to 40% of all teens have an experience that. That relationships with all, everyone, adults, children, adolescents, is all a normal part of it. Fantasy, all types of fantasy is a normal part of sexuality. And I think recognizing that all teenagers have sexual lives, even though they're not sexually active, is a crucial part of our recognition of adolescence and sex that's really been left out.
What are some of the questions that keep coming up in your practice pertaining to sexuality?
For girls, probably the most common question is, I want to be able to control my own sexual life. I don't feel that I can. Either my parents, the church that I'm involved with, or my boyfriend, or sometimes girlfriend, are controlling it. And I don't know what to do about that. I don't know how I can be much more in charge. And then they start talking about it. And slowly, I think it kind of emerges what they're doing to make that not work out. So that's usually the process with girls. Many girls come in, Terry, because they've heard about or they've read about or they've dreamt about having an orgasm. They have this fantasy about it, and it hasn't happened yet. And they may be 18 or 19. They expect it to happen, and they want to talk about it, and they kind of want very practical sex advice. You know, how am I going to make this happen?
Can you give them that kind of advice?
I've certainly, I would say, you know, I've certainly had experience talking to teens about it. What I do know is that maybe 70% of teenage girls never really experience an orgasm during their teen years. And instead, I talk with them much more about ways to know what their desire is, what do they really like, what are they passionate about, what are their fantasies about. I will talk with them about masturbation. Have they done it? Has it brought them pleasure? So rather than give advice, I think I try to start a line of questioning for girls and young women about their sexuality and really whether or not they're pointing in the direction of their own desire.
Well, I think this gets to an interesting gender difference for a lot of teenagers. You say that 70% of teenage girls probably haven't experienced orgasm. Is that the statistic you used?
That's the what the studies generally indicate. Mm-hmm. And it drops down in the 20s, becomes much more common. Many teenage girls, as I said earlier, can't negotiate sexual relationships well. So they're not able, I think, to even voice what would give them pleasure. That makes it hard to have an orgasm with a partner when you really cannot say what does give you pleasure.
So a lot of teenage girls haven't experienced orgasm but by the time they have their first sexual encounter with somebody. Whereas I think it's fair to say that most teenage boys have experienced orgasm through masturbation or wet dreams or whatever before they actually have a sexual encounter with another person. So in that sense, boys and some girls are coming at their first sexual experience from really different places.
That's absolutely right, Terry. And it's one reason that both boys' stories and girls' stories are included in the book that I wrote, because I think it gives you insight to think about the different positions, really, that girls and boys come at sex from. And it applies, I think, to many adult relationships, too. This is still carried through in the adult years, and learning how to express yourself for girls and for boys, I think learning how to listen, to be empathetic, and maybe to not be so focused on performance issues.
Some boys and some girls actually masturbate quite a bit as teenagers, either before they've had a sexual encounter or even after they've had sexual encounters. I think there was a period when masturbation was seen as growing hair on your hands and, you know, paving the path to hell and all kinds of stuff in between. I don't think there's nearly the amount of guilt and fear associated with it that there once was. But tell me from your experience, what are some of the anxieties connected now to masturbation for adolescents?
Well, for boys, definitely the concern that they won't show up as well. Daniel, one of the boys in the book, was involved in the jock club. And this was a group of boys who regularly masturbated together. But more important, they told stories about their masturbation feats. So he would often be masturbating and thinking about his buddies or his dad. You know, I mentioned earlier, this is a kid without a father. And that was the focus of a kind of lot of his masturbation skills. He was very fearful that his buddies would find out that he didn't quite measure up to them. So that was the focus of his kind of masturbation fears.
That's really sad, isn't it, to have performance anxiety even when you're masturbating?
Yeah. You know, that you asked me what I learned about boys and girls in this book. I have a lot more empathy for boys and men listening to them talk about their early sexual experiences. Because to imagine as you're masturbating alone, and boys have the advantage of they've got the mechanical equipment right out there, they can make it work. And then to imagine that they're not really able to feel in their body or in themselves, and they're worried about what other people, other boys are thinking about them is very, very sad, Terry.
My guest is Dr. Lynn Ponton, author of The Sex Lives of Teenagers. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Lynn Ponton, is the author of the new book, The Sex Lives of Teenagers. There's, you know, been a lot of debate for a long time now about whether parents or the schools or the clergy are best at sexually educating young people. From having talked to a lot of young people in your practice, what kind of sex education seems to actually be the most valuable?
It's, we live in a culture that is unwilling to talk about sexual matters. And even though we see explicit sexual images in the media, the culture at best is a semi-restrictive culture around issues related to sexuality. This makes it very, very difficult, really, for young people to be educated about it in the way that they need to. To address first maybe the schools, 2 years ago, the government spent $280 million on abstinence-only sex education. And this is in contrast to sex education that would discuss a range of possibilities for teenagers. 50% of teens are sexually active at age 16. These types of programs are not effective at educating the group that's sexually active. And I have some question about really how they educate the rest of them, too. So that's a very big concern. Many states do not have comprehensive sexual education. They may have one lecture for an hour in the entire upbringing of the young person. So that area of what the schools is doing is a very big question. Then, just to say second, all teens I've worked with would like their parents to discuss sexual matters with them. They admire their parents when they do. They may kind of blow them off or blow off the conversation, but they feel like it's cool when their parents can say something to them directly about sex. They feel like it's honest, and they see it as the parent kind of pushing the tip of the envelope. The kids know it's a taboo in our culture, and they admire parents for dealing with it.
Now, you point out in your book that adolescents today are sexually maturing physically 2 years earlier than other generations did, which means that they're physically ready for sex before they might be emotionally or cognitively ready for it. And what are some of the ways you think that's complicating lives for young people today in ways that they perhaps weren't quite as complicated for previous generations?
This is perhaps, other than the emergence of HIV on the scene, the early maturation has affected the sexual development of teens more than anything else. And you have boys at 13 and 14 looking like 20, 21-year-old men, and with the physical equipment really ready to have intercourse. But the mind really does not develop at the same rate, and that's both the intellect and certainly the emotional capacity, and also morals and values as a part of that. So it's a dangerous thing to have the physically developed body without any of the other aspects of it. Girls, to complicate things, are developing even 2 years earlier than boys, so that the average girl has her first period now by the end of her 11th year, early 12th year. Many girls are going through puberty at age 8 or 9. And as the parent of teenage daughters, you know, I've taken my daughters out. They are now in their later teen years, and I've really watched men and women react to them as adults, knowing full well that the girl I'm with is really emotionally 11, 12, or 13, and seeing how inappropriate and how difficult that is for young people today.
So do you think that because girls are more physically matured at a young age than their counterparts were generations ago, that they feel more pressured to engage in sex?
Absolutely. And they're seen by others as more available for sex. If you look 20 years old, you may not be asked about your age. There's certainly laws regarding statutory rape, but a lot of them are disregarded. And many girls try to act older, too. They try to kind of grow into their body, and they act older, and they act like they've had the experience. So that makes it difficult, too. Generally, girls are their first sexual experience occurs with a boy that's a couple years older. And with girls developing earlier, you can have girls at 11 or 12 who are having quite extensive sexual lives. This is something that developmentally they're really not ready for.
Do you think that the art of saying no has changed as circumstances have changed?
I hope that the art of saying no is still there, Terry. That's definitely something you've kind of got to grow into. You know, I mentioned that teenage girls don't negotiate well. They really do not know how to say no well. And learning, I think, as the mom of teenage girls, helping them learn how to say no is really one of the vital things. And it's not only say no. You don't just say no and that stops the conversation with a partner. You've got to take it a step further, really build on that, and say other things. So it's about saying no, and then what do you do? Do you suggest we go to the movies? Do you have an alternative? Do you say to the boy, boy, this really made me feel strange. I don't think we're ready for that. But you've got to give them the lines that follow the no.
Dr. Lynn Ponton is the author of The Sex Lives of Teenagers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from museumshop.com, an online boutique of products from museums around the world, including the Louvre in Paris and the British Museum in London, museumshop.com, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Chicago's renowned Steppenwolf Theater celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with two founding members, Gary Sinise and Terry Kinney, and two early members, Joan Allen and Laurie Metcalf. All four have become stars. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.